Radio Buddhist Youth Association. Good day, everybody. You're listening to the sound of universal compassion. Today is the 15th of September. We are continue listen to Master Tenjin Chosen's previous program, Meditation, Dying, and Karma. And please enjoy.
Welcome to the program. I hope your week has gone well. Last week, we spoke about taking refuge in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. After we recorded the program, Planet FM's very lovely producer, Elizabeth, and I got talking about it, and she mentioned that I had presented quite a lot of dense information, and so people might have felt a little overwhelmed. I hope those of you who listened got the gist of the talk. The Tibetan scriptures are mainly written for scholar monks who do a lot of study and debate, and sometimes are presented in a way that's not always easy to understand. So let me put it this way. Taking refuge basically means that we recognize we have a problem and that somebody else knows the way to fix it. So, for instance, when we feel ill, we may go to a doctor. In that instance, we're taking refuge in the doctor. However, if we're wondering what to have for dinner, it's not necessary to ask the doctor. If we make an appointment to do that, our doctor will probably recommend we see a psychiatrist. The point I'm trying to make is that our taking refuge in the doctor is only temporary and only for a specific type of problem. When, however, we realize that our whole life is a never-ending continuum of problems which we need to fix once and for all, we have to find a different kind of refuge. Again, it's not much use going to the doctor saying, "Doc, my life is a complete mess. Please give me some medicine to sort all my problems out." Again, the doctor will most likely give you the phone number of his friend, the psychiatrist. But unfortunately, no matter how much we lie on the psychiatrist's couch, it's very unlikely all our difficulties will be resolved. Some symptoms might be relieved, and even some deep-rooted difficulties might come to light and be dealt with. But I've never heard of any mental health worker completely banishing all a patient's problems from the tiniest to the mightiest. That seems to be the function of religion, or at least the promise of religion. Each religion tells us that it has an endpoint that is the attainment of some kind of everlasting state free from suffering. For some, it's a union with God. For others, it's the attainment of paradise with 1,000 Vestal Virgins. But for Buddhism, it's the state of mind of ultimate knowledge and peace, beyond concepts such as happiness and unhappiness. It's not possible to describe this state in words, because words usually represent concepts. And, as I say, the state of enlightenment is way beyond concepts. But you can gain a little understanding by remembering the Buddha sitting under the Bodhi tree on a bit of kusha grass while his father sat on silk cushions in his palace. To his father, Suddhodana, it would probably have been very uncomfortable to have to sit with only a bit of grass between him and the hard ground. But the Buddha's peace of mind did not rely on silk or grass. Wherever he was, the Buddha was perfectly at home with a mind that saw no difference in comfort between the grass and the silk cushion. If we recognize that state of mind as the solution to all our problems, rather than a place where one's body is always healthy, flowers always bloom, food is always delicious, and companions are always delightful, then we will want to work towards attaining it. To do that, we have to learn how to do it, and so we need a teacher. In the same way as we need a doctor for a medical problem, we need a teacher for our spiritual problem. And that's where our reliance on the Buddha comes in. So we examine who the Buddha was and what he said, see if his teachings accord with our experience and are worthy to follow. And if we decide he was authentic and what he said will serve our purpose, we put our trust in him and his teachings and lead our life according to that. That is taking refuge. Basically, if you want to know whether the Buddha can help or not, remember that first of all, he's free from all the mental distortions that plague our lives. Not only the gross distortions, but even the subtle imprints. Then also, because Buddhas see exactly how things are, they have no fear. Nothing appears to them as dangerous or threatening. and they have a complete ability to show others the way to such freedom. If we examine our attitude to other beings, we have love and compassion for our friends and those who help us out, but we hate our enemies and couldn't really care less about strangers. A Buddha, on the contrary, regards every single being with the same love and compassion a mother regards her only child. That doesn't depend on whether beings have worshipped or helped the Buddha or not. Out of love and compassion, a Buddha will help even someone who tries to torture and kill him. Very briefly, this is the kind of being we are putting our trust in when we take refuge in the Buddha. Then taking refuge in the Dharma means that we take the Buddha's teachings as a guideline for how we live our lives, trying our best to follow what the Buddha taught. And then as we get more and more skillful in our practice, we gain realizations, slowly clearing the distortions from our minds and becoming more and more like the Buddha. Along the way, we will need intelligent friends who have already taken this path and experienced the benefits to help us. Of course, the more experienced they are, the better they will be able to help us. So the Sangha we put our trust in and take as our refuge is particularly those beings who have freed themselves from suffering, the arhats. Of course, such people are not common and can be hard to come by. So Sangha also refers to the monks and nuns, and even in a wider sense can include the whole community of practitioners who have the ability to help us a little on the way. Now that's a swift review of what we spoke about last week, and I hope it brings some clarity to the topic. Let's now do a little meditation on the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, first of all setting a good motivation for this whole program today. Remembering that motivation is what makes an action positive or negative, let's take a moment to look at our minds and see what our motivation for listening to this program is. If it's just some kind of entertainment or to gain benefit for this life, try to change it so that the program will benefit you much more. The best motivation is to realize your highest potential to be of greatest benefit not only to yourself, but to all beings. Please try to set this kind of motivation because then the benefit will not be lost until you reach enlightenment. Thank you. Now sitting comfortably, concentrate your mind on your breath, letting the thoughts come and go without being involved in them. Just be aware of the mind's processes without being caught up in any of the content. imagine before you a figure of the Buddha, sitting in meditation pose on a lotus. He's golden, made of light and radiant, emitting light in all directions. Those rays of light are filled with love and compassion and go out to touch every living being, bringing them everything they could wish for. Remember that the Buddha sees everything exactly as it is, has no sense of self, and so is completely free from fear. He's perfect in knowing what every being needs to work towards enlightenment, and so is able to guide everyone according to their own needs. To the Buddha, it doesn't matter who or what it is. He's only concerned to help whether beings believe in him or not, whether they want to harm him or not. He acts in exactly the same way to all. Teachings that tell us that our problems lie within our minds and not outside. Our strong sense of an independent, inherently existing self makes us attached to whatever appears to help us, push away and hate whatever appears to harm us, and be neutral to everything else. We develop emotions to whatever we come across, and it is these emotions and their imprints that constantly keep us restless and disturbed and dissatisfied. Compare this to the mind that is at peace with whatever arises and has every ability to deal in the very best way with every situation without stress or disturbance. Isn't that the kind of mind you'd like to develop?
Oh.
about the people who could help you attain such a mind. Others have already practiced the path and are further on the ways than ourselves. They're in especially good position to help us along the path. Remember especially those who now see reality as it exists and are free from all suffering and dissatisfaction, even though they may not yet be Buddhas. Imagine taking advice from them and gaining your own realizations on the path. Could you develop reliance on them? If you've developed some faith in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, let your mind soak in that faith. Let it reach deep into your mind.
Oh,
Thank you. Now come out of meditation. Considering the qualities of the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha again and again will strengthen our refuge, and the more we practice the Dharma and gain some realizations, even though they may not be very great, the more we will come to realize the truth of what the Buddha said. At the beginning of this series of programs, I talked about the importance of the spiritual friend or master, someone who you can take as a guide on the Buddhist path. If you can find someone like that, they can, of course, become a refuge that includes the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. The best teacher we could possibly get would be a Buddha, but to say the least, there are not that many Buddhas around today, and even if we came across one, we may not even be able to recognize him or her. It's no easy matter to find a Buddha, or even an Arhat, to rely on as a teacher. So really, the best we can hope for is to find a well-qualified stand-in. And what, you may ask, does that mean? Well, basically it means that the person should have a good knowledge and lots of experience of the three higher trainings, moral discipline, concentration, and wisdom. A person who has moral discipline avoids harm to others and serves them wherever possible. That is why we take vows and precepts. By taking and keeping vows, such as not killing, stealing, and so on, our commitment to avoid harming others is so much stronger than if we don't take the vows. A good spiritual guide will be very committed to benefiting and not harming other beings, so will usually hold vows and be very careful about how they live. Then, when we talk about meditative concentration, it really means having such strong concentration that you can put your mind on any object and it will stay there without moving for as long as you like. Pretty difficult, isn't it? But that is also something to look for in a spiritual friend. And then thirdly, a good spiritual friend will have used that concentration to analyze and look deeply into how things exist. He or she will have realized how things are like an illusion. They don't have an independent, inherent existence at all, but are just a coming together of causes, conditions, and parts, and a label stuck on by the mind. Now, we'll talk about this a bit later, but this is the wisdom one gets when using special insight to realize how through our delusions we create a reality that is in fact quite different from the actual reality. Now, when you come across a spiritual friend who appears to have all these qualities, you might think that you've found someone you can really trust. But before taking them on as a guide, it's a good idea to try and figure out what their motivation is first. You probably know of evangelical preachers, especially on American TV, whose sermons often include urging their followers to contribute large sums of money to them. I've even heard of some teachers who demand that disciples donate all their possessions to them. From our point of view, this is almost surely a sign that the teacher is not an authentic spiritual guide. A teacher has to be principally concerned with the disciple's spiritual well-being and not much concerned with his or her own comfort. The more a teacher operates out of compassion for others, the less likely he or she will look for wealth or adulation from students. So if a teacher seems to thrive on praise and respect of the students, we better beware. We've covered all this in some depth in the second or third program of this series, but as the spiritual mentor is standing in for the Buddha and can come to represent the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, it's worthwhile going over it again. The spiritual mentor can become the most important person in our lives, so we should be careful about choosing him or her, but once we've done so, we must keep our faith and respect for them strong. And now time is up. Thank you for joining me today, and please do so again next week. Until then, may your mind remain ever peaceful.
connecting your community.